Please come to order.
Just one moment. Oh, well, go ahead, Marshall. Go ahead and call it. Yep.
Please come to order. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Werke, Judge Connolly, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning and good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. The first case is A20-0510, Stephen Fisher, Appellant versus Fisher Kinnunen Partnership LLP, respondents. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for Appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. When you start your argument, each of you please state your name for the record and the party that you represent. And the clock will start as soon as you start. And if you have any troubles, you just let me know. And we're ready for you, Counsel for Appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the court, my name is John Sullivan on behalf of Appellant Mr. Stephen Fisher. We are here today because our law firm failed Mr. Fisher, and we botched his filing of the complaint under Rule 504. Despite Mr. Fisher having no culpability for this error, the district court denied his Rule 60-02 motion to vacate the judgment. The central issue in this appeal is whether our law firm's mistake justifies punishing Mr. Fisher.
What I hear you saying, Mr. Sullivan, in some fashion is that you're throwing yourself on the mercy of the court trying to exonerate or exculpate your client from the harsh realities of the mandates of filing. How do we get around the fact that your client acknowledged that he was made aware of the fact that, as you said, you blew the deadline? He was made aware of that and at that point continued to negotiate or decide strategy on getting the matter resolved. How do we set that aside because he had actual knowledge?
The actual knowledge doesn't start the quote-unquote shot clock of the due diligence time period. You know, I see Rule 6002 having three, I guess the Findon factors having three separate time analyses when reviewing those. For the reasonable excuse prong, the time frame is up until the date to file. And you look at the facts up until, in this case, September 14th, 2019.
Well, this is where I'm very confused about your argument as far as your briefing, because it appears that on the due diligence factor, the Findon factor, you are relying on a start date of due diligence from when entry of judgment would have been. And that's contrary to case law. And I'll call your attention, of course, to Cole and Gams, which specifically articulate that we are to look at when there is, in fact, an awareness of the mistake.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with the analysis of Cole and Gams deciding that the clock starts at the time the movement learns of his or her error of omission. I understand in dicta on page 39, it says due diligence is assessed from the time that the movement learns from his or her error or omission. And then it goes on to cite four separate cases, but none of them support that actual proposition. And all four of them rely and cite Findon that due diligence starts at the notice of the entry of judgment.
So you're referring to the signal of the Supreme Court that says, see also, and then the several cases that have to do with different procedural context. I assume that's what you're getting at.
Yes, the cases Wynn, Charson, Connolly, and Kohler.
What case are you going to point us to that's a published authority that undoes Kohler Gams?
Well, the issue in Kohler Gams was, does Rule 6002 apply in the Rule 504 context? Kohler Gams doesn't analyze with necessary particularity the due diligence prong of Findon. And case law is replete that due diligence begins at the notice of entry of judgment. But even if the court decides that due diligence is assessed from the date the case is deemed dismissed, which was September 14th, 2019, we are only talking about a 3, maybe 4 month time period in which he, Mr. Fisher, had actual knowledge of the filing deadline. And on page 15 of my brief, I cite 7 examples
where you're citing, I hate to interrupt your argument, but I read the cases you cited too. All of those are instances where the court did in fact say that there was due diligence for whatever the variety of reasons. What about this case? What do we have for persuasive authority when a court says due diligence, the element of the Findon factor was not met?
Your Honor, the case is cited stand for the proposition that a 4 month time period between knowledge and filing the Rule 60.02 motion is sufficient.
Which case are you referring to?
Page 15 of my brief, starting with Golovich 412-760. Appellant acted with due diligence when he moved to vacate 4 months after he received notice of judgment. And then Wills, Builder, I've set 7 separate cases that look at the due diligence factor and say 4 months is sufficient. You know, and we argue that we only waited 21 days if we assume that the court's notice to show cause was that kind of de facto notice of entry of judgment. Unfortunately, there's only one case, and it's unpublished, that analyzes with the necessary particularity the issue of when does the due diligence clock start in the Rule 504 world. And that was before Cole or Gams, but I think it's instructive. And the Court of Appeals looked at those timelines and said, we are going to wait until the court enters judgment to decide when we start that clock.
Now, counsel, first of all, which case are you referring to? And in any of the cases where the measurement, where the clock is, or you know, the time period is triggered by the entry of judgment, in any of those cases, did the party know in advance of entry of judgment of their error? Because that's what we're dealing with here, learning of an error much earlier, or well, earlier than the entry of judgment, and not following, and not getting the document filed as the court rules require as quickly as possible after the error is discovered.
Yeah. Your Honor, the cases that the case in the Court of Appeals that was decided in the beginning of 2016 was Fogarty v. Bella, and the person had knowledge long before the court dismissed the case, but said we are going to begin the due diligence clock at the time the appellant learns of the error. Here.
Learns of the error, or that the
learns of the error.
So the error
here learns. We're going to start the clock at the time that, not at the time they learn of the error, but at the entry of judgment. And they learned of the error prior to the entry of judgment. Excuse me. Here, yes, Mr. Fisher did learn about the error 4 days after the complaint was due. But those 85 days between realizing of the mistake and filing the complaint, Mr. Fisher, at the advice of counsel, took one last ditch effort to resolve the case.
But Mr. Sullivan, isn't that a strategy as far as case resolution? You could have filed the complaint and still attempted to negotiate settlement. I mean, you can still negotiate settlement today, even though you're having an appellate court argument. Why would that not be strategy as far as trying to push an outcome?
Your Honor, that's 100% correct. And that was the hardest hurdle for the district court to overcome is, why didn't you just file it right away? Why didn't you file it? And then also serve
the- Isn't that the policy of the Finden factors and due diligence? Is I remember when this went into place, having been out there a long time, that it was to try to get rid of all the pocket filings and to be able to clean up messes where one party may have filed and nobody files an answer. I mean, why would that not be adverse to the policy of getting people to file their papers in court in a timely fashion?
The policy of the rule was to ensure judicial oversight of cases and to ensure cases weren't just pocket filed and then people sat on the sidelines and cases, you know, percolated in the distance.
Exactly. So there was no reason that, let me rephrase that. You could have filed, you acknowledge that, you could have filed the petition, the Correct. Complaint after you realized that the time deadline had passed.
Correct.
But you chose not to.
Our law firm decided not to.
Mr. Sullivan, am I correct that you would have to meet all four of the factors in order to get us to reverse or find there was an abuse of discretion?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, you know, and I mean, the counting of the days are kind of all over the map. I mean, you know, 85 days, you know, worse than some, not as worth as others. So it isn't your best argument that, you know, the court analyzed prejudicial as neutral. And I guess I didn't see any prejudice. So I don't know why that wouldn't have favored you. But isn't your sort of strongest argument is, okay, you're right. This case, you know, we knew it, well, we found out it happened. And then, you know, we could have filed it immediately, but we didn't. And our reasonable excuse is, hey, we were trying to settle this, or, you know, or we were trying to, you know, do this other strategy. And isn't that your best argument for reasonable excuse? I mean, it's not that just, you know, it happened the first time, you know, it wasn't filed, but it's not like you just sat on it and did nothing for the 85 days. You were trying to do something, and your reasonable excuse is, okay, we tried, it didn't work. But that doesn't mean, you know, I just went on vacation for 85 days and didn't do anything. Isn't that your best argument? And isn't that also sort of where I'm not so sure the district court's analysis on reasonable excuse is that great. So why don't you sort of amplify that in the couple of minutes you've got left as to why the reasonable excuse argument, the district court blew that?
Your Honor, as the record is clear, Mr. Fisher was unaware of the filing deadline and it blew by and we informed him. After he was informed of the error, we informed him that he now has a choice on whether he wants to fire Besson Flanagan or proceed with Besson Flanagan of counsel. He decided to continue being represented by us. After that, we informed him of what we thought the best strategy was moving forward. We gave him our advice and he took it. And that advice was, let's try one more time to settle the case. And then if that fails, let's file it. And so Mr. Fisher's culpability was zero for missing the deadline.
I just need to say again, and I sound like a broken record. You could have filed and continued to negotiate. What I'm hearing is that you were using that as leverage because you never did file the papers. Why didn't you file the papers?
But I think we need to delineate between the attorney's decision not to file and Mr. Fisher's due diligence in maintaining representation with Besson Flanagan. And I don't think that transfers the culpability to Mr. Fisher, both with the failure to file on time and the decision on when to file. And I think both of them were made at the behest of counsel.
And so you talk about counsel that what you were doing then is attempting to settle the case in the meantime. Although I guess not talking with opposing counsel about the fact of the blown deadline, but did you send a settlement agreement? Did you participate in some mediation? What were you doing that's an effort to settle the case?
Well, up until September.
I mean, after September, what did you do?
September 14th. There's no question before then they were with.
Right. I'm talking about your rationale of we wanted to try and settle it after we learned of the blown deadline. That's what we did. What was your effort to settle the case after the blown deadline?
After the blown deadline and after we informed Mr. Fisher of our error and allowed him the time to decide how we would like to proceed, we informed him that sending a notice of shareholder meeting would probably be the best way forward.
And how is that a settlement of the litigation?
Well, it at least would create settlement discussion and kind of refocus our attention on the issues of the entity. And when you look at, I'm now at the time limit and I will save my remaining comments for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, if you could state your name and the party you represent.
Yep, the court counsel, this is John Breyer, law firm of Kutek Rock on behalf of the appellee in this case, Lisa Peterson-Kanunen. The death nail of this appellate court case is what happened after Mr. Fisher learned that he missed the filing date. He did not choose to file the complaint. He waited a full month and decided to file, or rather present, Ms. Lisa Peterson-Kanunen with a notice of joint special meeting of stockholders. There was only two items on that agenda. One was to fire her as an employee, and two was to dissolve the company. That notice, the appellant tries to spin as a settlement proposal. To be clear, there was never any settlement discussions whatsoever after they missed the September deadline. Nothing. No calls, no emails, nothing. Only after the appellee objected to the shareholder meeting and it did not occur, did the appellant file the complaint. And he didn't file it right away then either. He waited yet another month before filing the complaint. He is now 85 days past the filing deadline, not because of any mistakes made by his attorneys, but because he chose to wait, try an alternative B, an alternative plan to force his litigation strategy. That's a client decision. That's not an attorney's decision. They may have presented him with options, but ultimately it was Mr.
Breyer, why isn't that a reasonable excuse? I mean, you know, they blew it, you're right, you know, but you know, and then the question is, why did they delay the 85 days? And what was, why is what they did not a reasonable excuse?
Because they tried to do what their complaint couldn't do, which is try and eliminate Ms. Peterson-Kanunen from the company. That was a decision. Now, that may have been strategy, but it's a decision. It's an affirmative action on behalf of their client to decide not to file the complaint. And all the court cases you read, all the court cases that have been issued, all say that you have to work diligently to file a complaint after you've learned that you've missed the deadline. The excusable aspect of this reasonable excuse, has to do primarily with what the client knew and when they knew it. Now, Mr. Fisher has cited a number of cases in which the client wasn't necessarily involved in the decision-making or the mistake of missing the filing deadline. They were simply unaware of it. Here, that is not the case. Mr. Fisher knew that the deadline had passed. Now the ball is in his court. What is he going to do? The law tells him he needs to file his complaint. Now, if he wants to go ahead and serve a notice of a shareholder meeting, pursue settlement discussions, or some alternative strategy, there's no reason he couldn't have done that together with filing the complaint. But if we strip that away, if we say, look, litigants don't have to file because they're following the advice of counsel, or we're going to allow them to try all sorts of alternatives before actually filing the complaint, then you've gutted Rule 504. It's a useless rule. And that's not what the rule was put in place to do. This case has started back in 2015. These parties have engaged in discussions. They've engaged in discovery. There's been a forensic accounting. There's been two separate mediation attempts with two separate mediators. And I would also direct the court's attention to this issue too. That mediation focused largely on the complaint and whether it was going to be filed and used as leverage throughout. And on a particular note, on September 9th, 2019, Mr. Fisher, the appellant, demanded that we provide a counteroffer on or before September 13th, one day before the filing deadline. Otherwise, as he threatened, I will file the complaint. So this whole notion that he didn't learn of the filing date until after it had passed is really circumspect. But even if that's not the case, if we give him the benefit of the doubt, we start measuring his actions when he claims he knew, which is 4 days after, and examining what he did and whether he did it in a diligent way. And here, you cannot reach the conclusion that he did. He chose an alternative path. That was his choice. That's the bed he has to sleep in. And this case needs to be dismissed.
You agree that if we agree with you on the third Findon factors, that it ends there? Or do you believe we need to analyze all of the Findon factors?
It's a requirement that all Findon factors be found in the favor of the appellant. Here you can just decide on a single Findon factor and the complaint remains dismissed and this case comes to an end. The district court got this right. The district court did a thorough analysis on the circumstances of this case. And ultimately, discretion rests with the district court. This is somewhat of a fact-laden motion. The judge needs to determine whether due diligence was performed on behalf of the appellant, and also as to when the timing of the appellant knew that he had a duty to file the complaint. The judge checked all the boxes, went through all the Findon factors, and while the appellant may take issue with how she decided those, it's the discretion of the district court. She exercised that discretion appropriately, and this court should affirm her decision. And if there isn't any other questions, I will yield my time.
Great, it doesn't appear there are. Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have five minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few follow-up points. First, this is not a useless rule, even if this case is allowed to proceed. The main question in Cole v. Games was, does Rule 6002 apply? And the Minnesota Supreme Court unequivocally said yes. And it said yes because Rule 504 is a procedural rule, not a statute of limitations. Respondents attempted to, and so far have successfully used Rule 504 as a statute of limitations, and that's not its purpose. And relief under Rule 6002 doesn't swallow Rule 504. And the evidence is in the court filings. The rule has worked. Cases are now filed with the court, and this is one of the rare exceptions. Second, respondents refer to the email Mr. Grimsrud sent the week the complaint was due. That is not knowledge of the filing deadline. It was merely a statement that if we do not receive a counteroffer from you, which we've been waiting for a month, and unbeknownst to Mr. Grimsrud, respondents were waiting in the weeds, hoping we would forget about the filing deadline. And their wishes came true.
You did threaten to file the papers if they didn't respond.
Correct, Your Honor. And we made a mistake to not file on time. And we made a second mistake not to file right away. But again, both mistakes are a reasonable excuse, and both mistakes should not be imputed onto Mr. Fisher. Again, when looking at the totality of the circumstances and the purpose of the rule, the purpose of the rule wasn't to dismiss cases. The purpose of the rule was to ensure case oversight. And allowing this case to proceed allows the purpose and the spirit of the rule to continue.
You know, in all fairness, one way to oversee cases is to get rid of them. I mean, you know, so I would you respond to Mr. Breyer's point? You know, I understand the strategy, but, you know, if we, I mean, everybody's got a strategy. And in this case, you know, obviously your strategy was unsuccessful, but why would we want to open the door to say, well, you know, a strategy is an excuse that gets you to, you know, reasonable. I mean, my concern would be, well, everybody's going to say whatever they did or didn't do was because it was a strategy. Either we were trying to pressure them or we weren't trying to pressure them or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I have some sympathy with Mr. Breyer's argument that, you know, why would we open that can of worms? So why would we want to do that, Mr. Sullivan?
To your first point, the court wants to dismiss cases on the merits, not on a procedural technicality. On the second point, I don't think or see this as a slippery slope. I don't think this opens Pandora's box. Again, a very small fraction of the cases aren't filed in the Rule 504 deadline. Unfortunately, this case wasn't and is one of the rare examples. But if the court allows Rule 6002 to become slightly broader and allow more cases to proceed if they are not timely filed, this is going to impact maybe one or two cases. Safeco is an example. The court ruled that Safeco was responsible for the failure to file as they were part of the settlement negotiations and hadn't responded for 2 years. But the district court in that case, importantly, ruled that Safeco acted diligently in responding to filing the complaint 5 months after the filing deadline. And they ruled that there wasn't any prejudice. Now, of course, the court ruled that they didn't have a reasonable excuse because they were aware of the filing deadline and were culpable for the failure to file. But that isn't the situation here. But I think that at least illustrates that, you know, district court found that 5 months was reasonable and they had knowledge of the filing deadline on the day of.
Mr. Sullivan, your time is up. If you wanted to wrap up, go ahead.
In closing, the court should not punish Mr. Fisher for his attorney's mistake, and a respondent should not benefit from a procedural technicality. It'd be unfair to Mr. Fisher and a perversion of Rule 504 to dismiss this matter. Accordingly, the court should reverse the district court's decision and remand this case for trial. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you both for your briefing, for your oral arguments today. Case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. Thank you.
Thank you.